Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hey everybody, it's Chris here. Hope you're well. Just before we begin, I just want to let you know that this episode was recorded just before President Trump announced that he was going to take 2 weeks to decide whether or not to join the Israelis in military action against Iran's nuclear facilities. So please bear that in mind as we begin.
Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Espresso Martini. Matt, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. How are you? What a week. I'm glad this wasn't one of our off weeks.
Oh, yeah, I know. What a week it is. It's quite hard to keep up with it all, to be honest with you. But we're in, the luxury position of, at the moment, at least being out of the danger zone of everything, because watching all the events unfold, I feel like a weird voyeur stroke spectator sometimes, because so many things where I've been in my living room the last like 4 years just watching Sky News live as all sorts of craziness kind of is unleashed in the world, and there I am sitting in my living room watching it all. It's just like, it feels a bit weird, if you know what I mean. But it's not entertaining, but it is very interesting, but it's kind of weird feeling. So I'm grateful that we're not the ones getting bombed at this time.
May we maybe one day live in precedented times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh dear, done enough with unprecedented. Yeah. And also in London this week, it's very hot. Yet again, a household debate about whether we should get air conditioning or not has come back, and I'm losing that debate. So there we go.
we mentioned this before we started recording. Yeah, it's the same. It's finally summertime here. It's pretty hot out, but of course we're equipped for such temperatures, whereas most of you guys aren't. I remember that distinctly from my time over there. When I was in Parliament, one of the women that I worked with in the office there was like, oh, it's like we're going to have like a heat wave or whatever. And I think it was like she said it was going up to like 30°C, which is about 80 degrees Fahrenheit here. And where I'm from in like, you know, the mid-Atlantic, it was like that's just kind of normal summer. But no, when you're in that and you have no kind of like escape, especially on the tube, damn, I used to sweat my ass off down there a full suit on and everything. It can be pretty bad.
Yeah, the tube gets horrific, and sometimes you on the older train, so it's actually 30 degrees at the moment. So what is that in Fahrenheit?
That's about 80.
Yeah, so it's hot.
Yeah.
Just in case anybody wants to see That's what we're dealing with right now, with also the humidity that we always get in London too. So
what is it here? Yeah. It's 86 here.
86, yeah. Whew, just a bit hotter, yeah. But you got the aircon. Yeah. So
I got the air conditioning.
Oh, dear, but yeah, the tube. Unless you get on one of the newer trains, the tube is a nightmare. So anybody who's visiting London from overseas, bear that in mind. Take layers, because the other thing about London is the weather's a bit unpredictable. So you have to take like half your wardrobe with you. We're kind of getting out of that point now, where at least now it's just hot. And what I tend to do is take two or three spare t-shirts now when I'm out for a long period of time. I take spare clothes, but there we go.
When I was on the tube, I used to try to get by one of those windows right at like the end of the car. So you have like the like the wind coming in and everything. And that was like somewhat manageable. But otherwise, man, it was brutal down there.
Yeah, that wind's quite relieving, isn't it? Even though it's probably full of toxic whatever, it does feel quite relieving on a hot day. But New York, oh my God, New York subways. Yes. Oh, that's like standing in an oven.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, all I right. Forget those. But there we go.
Well, so, yeah, we got a lot to cover today.
We do. So our first story is going to be looking at, and probably our main story today is going to be looking at Israel versus Iran. Mm-hmm. Then we'll be looking at new documents that show Russia's FSB considers China a threat. Then we will look at MI6, who have appointed their first female head of the organization. And then we'll be wrapping up looking at the death of author Frederick Forsyth. So Matt, I'm going to hand over to you because Iran is your area of expertise.
Yeah, so we're of course a week into the conflict essentially. And I mean, so we're recording this Thursday late morning here on the East Coast. So, you know, take that into account with what we discuss here. It could be different by the time folks hear it. But yeah, so here's where we are right now. So last Friday, June 13th, the Israeli military launched a sweeping air campaign against Iran's nuclear program and senior military leadership, marking the start of what has quickly become the most expansive and direct conflict between the two nations in their history. The opening salvos of Operation Rising Lion began with precision airstrikes targeting nuclear facilities and killing top Iranian figures, including Chief of the General Staff Mohammad Bagheri, senior commanders of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC, and key nuclear scientists, continuing a campaign aimed at decapitating Iran's warfighting infrastructure and leadership. Israel's strategy appears to have been months in the making, involving not just air power but covert action. Before the first jets took off, Israeli operatives inside Iran launched remote-controlled spike missiles and sabotage drones, disabling key radar and air defense systems from within Iranian territory. Iranian authorities claim to have uncovered remnants of Israeli-made weapon systems, remote launch gear, and even a drone factory operated by Mossad in a suburb south of Tehran. As the air war expanded, Israeli pilots, now operating with near-total air superiority, began striking dozens of missile launch sites and suspected enrichment facilities. More than 200 Iranian long-range ballistic missile launchers have reportedly been destroyed. Analysts say the number of missiles Iran is now able to launch has dropped dramatically, raising the question of whether the saturation attack doctrine that underpins Iran's missile threat has been blunted, at least for now. But the most fortified of Iran's nuclear sites, the Fordo Fuel Enrichment Plant, buried 80 meters under a mountain near the Iranian city of Qom, remains intact. Israeli weapons cannot penetrate it, and that's where the United States comes in. In the past 48 hours, President Trump has approved plans to join the war if needed, possibly deploying U.S. aircraft to destroy Fordo with 30,000-pound bunker-busting bombs. But so far, he's holding off on giving the order. The delay comes as his Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, attempts to broker a last-ditch ceasefire with Iran's foreign minister. Whether that diplomacy will succeed remains to be seen. This moment comes after months of internal division in the Trump administration and a dramatic shift in posture. For most of the spring, Trump had resisted Israeli pressure to launch preemptive strikes, convinced diplomacy might work. But that changed after Israeli intelligence presented a new dossier claiming Iran had quietly crossed a, quote, point of no return. According to reporting in The Economist and The Wall Street Journal, Israeli officials say Iranian scientists have hidden undeclared nuclear material, accelerated research on warhead design, and scheduled meetings with the IRGC's missile command to begin the mating process, integrating a warhead with a delivery system. If true, it would suggest Iran was on the verge of weaponization. But that assessment sharply diverges from the longstanding consensus of the U.S. intelligence community. American analysts acknowledge Iran has the technical ability to build a bomb quickly and is now just a week away from producing enough fissile material. Or I should say, it could produce enough fissile material in about a week. Not that they are going to be in a week. But they maintain that Tehran has not made the political decision to actually construct a nuclear weapon. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard reiterated this view publicly in March, and officials have expressed concern that Israel may be exaggerating worst-case scenarios to justify war. Inside the Trump administration, that divergence has led to a halting, inconsistent response. The president initially distanced himself from the Israeli attacks, then shifted tone after seeing the strike footage praised on Fox News. As Israeli air raids gained traction, Trump began claiming credit behind the scenes, touting American intelligence support and dropping hints about deeper U.S. involvement to come. CENTCOM Commander General Michael the Gorilla Carrilla has reportedly played a decisive role behind the curtain, pushing for a robust military buildup and guiding U.S. deployments into the region. Carrilla, an Iran hawk nearing the end of his tenure at Central Command, has been instrumental in shaping Pentagon policy, reportedly convincing Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to greenlight nearly every request for additional assets, from fighter jets and tanker refueling aircraft to additional carrier strike groups. Amid the strikes, however, one group has been notably absent from Israeli and American narratives, the Iranian people. As The Atlantic's Arash Azizi reports, many opposition activists inside Iran, people who once led mass protests against the regime, are now terrified and disillusioned. Civilians have been killed in airstrikes, including artists, teachers, and members of the country's reformist civil society. Even those who despise the Islamic Republic are struggling to view the Israeli campaign as a path to liberation. "This war is not helping us," one young activist in Tehran said. "It is destroying us. It is silencing the very people it claims to save." For now, Tehran has hinted it's open to resuming nuclear negotiations if the airstrikes stop. Whether Trump will let Witkoff's diplomacy play out or give the go-ahead for U.S. bombers to hit Fordo remains one of the most consequential questions in global affairs. And the answer to that question will echo for years to come.
Yeah. I mean, this whole thing can change the entire picture of the Middle East, which feels like stating the obvious. But there are quite a few people out there who've been asking me privately about like what the consequences of this war is going to be. And it could well be a big game changer. Could be because the biggest year in the Middle East for many was 1979 when the Islamic Revolution, you know, took over Iran. Yeah. And it kind of sent shockwaves through the Middle East. And, you know, obviously Iran being Shia and Saudi Arabia being Sunni, and it kind of created the beginnings of this sort of proxy war between the two that's led to the creation of like terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. You've had all the militias that that Iran have backed. And it's just been an ongoing kind of thing, really. So whoever, you know, if there is a regime change, then whoever takes over, be interesting to know whether they swing Shia or Sunni. And beyond that, to what extreme, whether they're moderate or whether they are kind of, yeah, of a more extremist bent. There's no guarantees that whoever takes over Iran, if there is a regime change, would be better than who's kind of currently in charge. So I'm just going to go a little bit into my sort of personal feelings and stance on things. And I'm going to come back to you, Matt, for your thoughts on this, because I think your thoughts will be more interesting than mine because you're more the expert in this area than I am. But one of the things I would say just on a sort of personal level, I'd love to see the current Iranian government fall, but I don't think this is the way to do it. Obviously, it's easy for me to say that, but I think, you know, history and recent history with Iraq has shown when an external force try and topple a government, it leads to a kind of terrible power vacuum and leads to a lot of uncertainty. The traditional way in the past, which is not necessarily better, but it's more controlled, is usually if you are going to topple a government, you kind of have somebody in mind in place already to kind of succeed. But just toppling something and letting a power vacuum happen. I mean, look at Libya, look at Iraq, look at, to some extent, Syria. Syria is still a messy picture. There's not quite, we haven't quite figured out exactly where that's going yet. So,
well,
you know,
Syria was a much messier picture for years.
Definitely.
Until
definitely.
December.
Yeah, definitely. And the current government, seems to be a lot better than Assad's regime, but there's still a chance that, you know, it could become another regime of sorts. But I think there are quite a few people trying to make sure it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So we'll see where that goes. I will just say as well, obviously, I am deeply concerned for Iranian and Israeli civilians who are kind of caught in the middle of all this. I was reading a very moving piece by the BBC the other day on a sort of phenomenon that's going on in Iran on social media, where people are sharing pictures of their house just before they leave to kind of document what may be gone by the time they get back. And that's a horrendous thought, really, to think that your house will just be gone. But that's a very, very big reality. And also likewise for Israelis as well. I mean, just as I woke up this morning, there was news of a Israeli hospital that had been hit. There have been, some missiles have got through the Iron Dome and caused casualties. I don't think there's been a huge death toll at this point, which, I would say is a positive for Israel. I don't wish a huge death toll, but certainly I think the Iranians have come off worse than Israel has in terms of the civilian killings. One ever extra thing I just want to add as well about kind of hearts and minds and things. Obviously currently, many feel Israel's become a global pariah over its disproportionate retaliation to October the 7th and the destruction of Gaza. Certainly in London, that comes up an awful lot. The killing of potentially 55,000 people as the Israelis target Hamas, and Hamas are embedded within the civilian population, has led to a horrific death toll that has really made it, really tarnished Israel's image. If you could say it had a positive image in the first place, some have always hated Israel, but this has definitely done nothing to make those who hate Israel feel differently. And on top of that, Israel's goal appears to be regime change over the just specifically targeting the nuclear program. If you go by Netanyahu's kind of targeting of Iranian leaders and also his sort of public speeches asking for the people to rise up against the kind of current government in Iran. So that violates international law, which then, again, doesn't help Israel's position. And that could also create problems for the US as well. And anybody who backs Israel, that could create some very legal dubious things. But obviously, again, with recent history in Iraq, America has a bit of Britain does too, has an interesting relationship with international law. And sometimes they ignore it and sometimes they kind of really hammer down on it. So, we'll put that out there. Only history and time will tell what actually comes of all that. One last thing. I was listening to a really good podcast called Conflicted by Eamon Dean. And Eamon Dean was a former member of Al-Qaeda who ended up becoming a covert source for British and American intelligence. And I don't always agree with him. He's very pro-Trump. And he actually weirdly has is a phenomenon I've noticed with Middle Eastern men I personally know. Quite a lot of them seem to be really into Trump. Trump seems to play to whatever sensibility or whatever they like. So I do find Eamon's feelings of Trump and thinking that Trump, he was saying that he thinks Trump's like a master strategist playing good cop, bad cop with Israel. And I'm not quite convinced. I could be wrong, but I'm not convinced that that's what's going on. I feel like Trump may have been caught on the back foot a little bit by some of this. Mm-hmm. But we'll come back to that more in a bit. But one thing that he did say that was interesting was that there are many Sunni Arab governments who are publicly condemning Israel's actions, but behind the scenes, they're not so concerned about Israel attacking Iran.
That's true.
And he said, possibly that's because, those governments have been on the receiving end of Iranian proxies, such as the Houthis, who've had a drawn-out conflict with Saudi Arabia. But what I would say is, civilians, ordinary citizens, I think there's a very different picture. I think a lot of, a lot of Muslims and citizens of the Arab world are quite pissed off with Israel and this action and are, again, labeling Israel as a terrorist state for what it's doing. So, yeah, that's the kind of my bit. So I'll come to you now, Matt, because I feel like I'm taking up a lot of time, but I think there's some interesting things you'll talk to us about. Uh-huh. I'm fascinated by the intelligence at the moment about the the difference between US and Israeli assessments. So the Israeli assessment's kind of saying that Iran could make a bomb shortly, whilst America's kind of, American intelligence, or at least via Tulsi Gabbard, seems to be saying that it's not as bad as the Israelis are painting it.
Right. The longtime assessment of the US intelligence community, and we have discussed this in previous episodes. I believe the most recent time this came up was back in April when Bibi came to Washington and was sort of, you know, prodding around, hey, we should do this. I think he would say, I think the Iranians are pushing towards a bomb. We have this intelligence. There was stuff that came up at the time about them not being able to put, to miniaturize a nuclear warhead to the extent that it could sit on top of a ballistic missile, that it would be some sort of a cruder device. We talked a lot about how I thought how that was just very difficult for them to deliver, you know, if they push through that path. BB's wanted to do this for 20 years. You know, this is his dream right now.
Yeah, yeah. There was a video compilation, wasn't there, by The Daily Show that showed from 2005 to now that BB's been saying it's imminent that Iran will have the bomb.
Yeah. BB's been saying that Iran is a week away from building a nuclear weapon for 20 years. I think that is true. However, so the divergence in the intelligence seems to have really sort of begun in the fall, after the pager beeper attack and the sort of concerted wave of airstrikes that really crippled Hezbollah, right? That then led to the collapse of the Syrian regime and Ahmad al-Shara, the once rebel leader, taking over the country, the Assad family moving into exile into Russia and perhaps Kazakhstan. Also, we think his brother may have been spotted at a coffee shop in Kazakhstan. I digress.
Yeah, I saw that.
I don't know what to make of that. Anyway, that then would have pushed, I think, the strategic calculus of the Iranians that the only sort of option they have left is to get really serious about building a weapon and putting it on a ballistic missile, right? At the time when this came up and we talked about it, that made sense to me as, you know, like, I don't know what else they would logically kind of turn to as like, well, what do we do now? You know, rebuilding the axis of resistance, the Iraqi militia groups that they're allied with are still largely intact, almost entirely intact. The U.S. strikes against them after October 7th were very kind of limited, but they're still largely intact. Hezbollah and Hamas are really poorly battered. And I think the process to rebuild them, if it could be done, if Israel would let them do it, especially not having that land bridge through Syria, how they would do that, I think is really complicated. That's an open question of mine that I'm still very much interested in. So if you are unable to sort of rebuild that strategic deterrent that Iran's axis of resistance represented for the Iranians, you know, what else would they logically go towards? I think it would be building a nuclear weapon. However, if you go into some of the details that were shared, and, you know, we'll have links in the show notes to articles from The Economist and The Wall Street Journal that talk about this a lot, it still sort of seems to me to be that they got serious on the question of how quickly could we build a crude nuclear device, and also maybe we should bring in the ballistic missile guys to talk about this stuff, right? It still feels like research and like just asking questions rather than the supreme leader saying, go ahead and build a bomb. You know, and that is in line with the consensus of the U.S. intelligence community since 2003, after the invasion of Iraq, that Ayatollah Khamenei shelved the nuclear program, but kept the option open to build one in the future. Right. So that represents a lot of, you know, research, academic study in the fields of like dual use technologies. Right. You know, the question that I'm sure a lot of people listening are asking is, OK, well, who's right? Are the Israelis right that this was sort of an imminent thing, that Iran was on the cusp of building a nuclear weapon and the Israelis wouldn't be able to stop it? Or, you know, is the U.S. assessment still correct. And, you know, this is sort of being cherry picked by the Israelis. A lot of groupthink, Iraq flashbacks, WMD stuff.
Well, yeah. The WMD thing's always in people's mind. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To justify this. The answer to that question is I don't know. I think, you know, some have argued that the degree to which Israeli intelligence has clearly penetrated the Iranian security establishment to include the nuclear program, it must clearly, from what we've seen, right, has to be to such an extensive degree that, well, surely they probably have a better insight into the workings of the Iranian nuclear program than U.S. intelligence agencies do. Mm. I think. Mm. I can't disagree with that argument in principle. Yeah, maybe. But I think it's also possible that there's a lot of groupthink and cherry picking and sort of worst case scenario catastrophizing by the Israelis post October 7th that has led to this. So I don't fully know what the answer is to, like, who's right. You know, were the Iranians on the cusp of building a bomb? Were they not? I don't know. But I see indications on either side that could ring true to me. Does that make sense?
It does. And one thought I've had for a while, I think we've talked about this privately, it feels like the Iranian regime has weakened in the last of 2 or 3 years. And I'm wondering whether the Israelis are seeing this window of, should we say, weakness as an opportunity to do something about it. Do you think they're exploiting that?
Yeah. I think Bibi Netanyahu has his personal self-interested reasons to sort of keep this regional war going for a long time. You know, he's facing a lot of sort of like corruption, legal issues and everything that, you know, once this crisis situation that Israel has been in that began on October 7th and is still in almost, you know, 20 months later, once that ends, you know, Bibi's going to face some serious questions about how he stays in office, right? And the longer he stays in office, he's sort of out of reach of these investigations and everything. I think that is true. But yes, I think to that point also, Bibi sees a once-in-a-lifetime historic opportunity to just clean the board and get rid of these real strategic threats that Israel face in the region from the axis of resistance being Hamas, Hezbollah, some of the other militias throughout the region, and ultimately the Iranians. I think, you know, this also sort of came up in the spring, the question of, you know, if there was ever a time to make a run at the Iranian nuclear program, it is now. And I think that is just objectively true. I can't disagree with that. Whether I think this is smart in the moment, whether this is good policy, whether the outcomes will be disastrous or not, those questions aside, I mean, I think this was the strategically best time to do this if you were ever going to do it.
Yeah. And if we cast our mind back a few weeks ago, it was reported that Mike Waltz angered Trump by his hawkish position on Iran and his coordinating with Netanyahu on military operations to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities without Trump's backing. And I get the impression, obviously, that this current Israeli action was initially started without US support and that Netanyahu gambled on Trump would support him if he made the first move. What do you think of that?
I think it's true. I mean, the reporting suggests that the serious planning for this began in December. Of course, yeah. I mean, the sort of intelligence legwork, you know, that Mossad would have done to get their forces, their equipment in place to do this, you know, like operating a drone factory in the suburbs of Tehran. Also, the southern suburbs of Tehran are a pretty conservative, regime-friendly place. It's, you know, the northern suburbs are sort of the more well-to-do, liberal, affluent parts of the city. The southern suburbs are a lot more working class, conservative, loyal to the regime. So I'm just from an operational standpoint, I find it interesting that they were doing this in a southern suburb. That stuff would have taken years. I think the legwork for sure began in December once Assad's regime collapsed. And I mean, they just had clear airspace to do this, you know, beforehand. Okay, this all Iraqi airspace is, I mean, free for the taking for the Israelis and have been for a long time. The Jordanians gets diplomatically complicated. I mean, I think the Jordanians would allow the use of their airspace to in a defensive posture, right, to swat away Iranian ballistic missile and drone attacks, as happened last spring and in the fall, of course. However, to, you know, mount a concerted air campaign against Iranian leadership and the nuclear weapons program, I don't think that's something that the Jordanians would at least publicly support. So, of course, that then pushes Israeli warplanes up through Syrian airspace, which before Assad was gone would present its own issues. So, yeah, I think Hezbollah and then Assad going were the two key dominoes that made this possible. And I think for Bibi and his calculus, just kind of irresistible.
And with regards to, should we say, the case for bombing Iran nuclear facilities, obviously there are people over here in the US who are kind of calling it a bit into question. Is it a case of the, with regards to maybe Netanyahu, that is sort of a case of the boy crying wolf too often to the point where now we don't believe him when it's an actual genuine problem? Or do you think it could be a bit overblown just for Netanyahu's political survival?
Maybe. I think there's probably truth in both of those assessments. Yeah. You know, I mean, yeah, Bibi certainly has his sort of personal self-interested reasons to do this and to keep this going, right? That's absolutely true. He has been saying that Iran is on the verge of developing a nuclear weapon for 20 years. That is also true. I think it is also true that following the collapse of Hezbollah and the Assad regime, that the Iranians started asking themselves serious questions. They may not operational questions, but serious questions in terms of research and development on, okay, how do we push to, you know, how would we push to build a nuclear weapon as quickly as possible and put it on a ballistic missile? I think all three of those questions, the answer could be yes, and that's okay, you know, just ideologically, like it's okay to say yes to all three of those questions, right? I think it's also probably, I think it's just objectively true to some degree. I don't think it's entirely BS what the Israelis were saying. Does it mean that their entire theory of the case, you know, that the Iranians were on the verge of developing a nuclear weapon and we were days away from being unable to stop it? I don't know that that's true, but I think the Iranians were certainly up to more activity following the collapse of Syria and Hezbollah.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you make of sort of Trump's political situation? Because he seems to be, his stance is sort of fracturing his support in the Republican Party. So the MAGA supporters tend to be more isolationist, whilst then, should we say, I'm hesitant to use the term neocon, but I couldn't think of a better description for the other side of the conservative coin in the US.
That's fair. I mean, that's just sort of a description. That's the word that you use to describe their ideology, you know?
Yeah,
definitely post the war on terror in Iraq and everything, it has sort of a negative, it sounds like a slur, you know, it has been used that way. But that is true. That is the field of their sort of conservative doctrine, their foreign policy doctrine. That's what it's called, is neoconservatism.
Yeah.
So let's back up here and say what the U.S. strike would look like, right? And the reporting has borne this out. And I think a lot of what we've seen on, you know, flight trackers and everything in the past week have definitely sort of suggest this, right? So the first option, right, or COA that, you know, they would say like in the tank where the Joint Chiefs meet, courses of action, right, would be extensive U.S. intelligence and tanker support, right? Which a few days ago, we saw this huge fleet of aerial refueling tankers depart bases across the continental U.S. and move into Europe, right? Where they're still sort of sitting. And there's an air bridge. There was last night. I was watching it live.
I keep missing them. Yeah. It's really annoying.
Yeah. I think maybe our timing's a little off time zone wise. It happens for me. It usually happens later at night where you're probably asleep. Mm. There's a consistent air bridge between Europe and the Middle East right now of U.S. Tanker and airlift aircraft right now. So that would be to the sort of first step of options that were presented to the president would be extensive intelligence and tanker refueling support, right? To sort of keep up the tempo of Israeli strike sorties against targets in Iran, whether that's leadership or nuclear sites, what have you, right? that then ratchets up to a U.S. strike on the Fordo enrichment plant, which, as you said in the intro, that's kind of their main enrichment facility that was disclosed to the IAEA in 2009, has always sort of been like their main site, that if you're going to take out the nuclear program, you have to get that too, right? And that's buried 80 meters under a mountain. The U.S. possesses a weapon. It's the GBU-57, or Massive Ordnance Penetrator, or MOP, and that's that 30,000-pound bunker buster that's been described as manufactured by Boeing. It's public. There's been so much written about this in the last week. It's publicly known to be able to penetrate as deep as 60 meters. Of course, you know, Fort Doe is thought to be buried 80 meters under the ground. So how do you make up that difference? I would offer that there are certainly capabilities that we don't know about, that we civilians don't know about. CENTCOM and the Pentagon are insistent that they could take out Fort Doe. I'm inclined to believe them because they know things we don't know. Maybe if this attack happens, that could be proven to not be true. But right now, I have no reason to sit here and wag my finger and go, no, you can't take out Fort Doe with one of these weapons if they're insistent that they could.
I guess the very least is you could block access to it.
Right. So you would collapse the access tunnels. You would suck the air out of the facility and kill anyone who's stupid enough to still be there. Like, why would you? There's the last place on Earth that I would want to be right now.
There's always a job's worth everywhere.
Yeah, like the janitor who's just there, that poor guy. Yeah, I would not want to be within 5 kilometers of Fort Doe right now.
Yeah.
Trump's thinking is, okay, we're going to do one strike on Fort Doe, and I don't mean one airstrike. It would probably be a series of airstrikes, but we'd really just focus on targeting and disabling Fort Doe, right? The strategic sort of assessment in the last week has been, if the objective is to take out the Iranian nuclear program, you cannot do that without taking out Fort Doe, right? And the Israelis don't have the ability, at least from the air. With commando raid, yeah, they could do it. It would be risky. It would be, you know, yeah, the stuff of movies or spy novels to do. But just objectively, you know, is the operation to take out Iran's nuclear program complete while leaving Fort Doe intact? The answer to that question is no, it's not. Whether Fort Doe could be, you know, disabled, demilitarized, dismantled as part of some sort of an agreement, ceasefire agreement to end the war. Yeah, I think that's also something that Witkoff is dealing with right now. But, you know, that's the Trump thinking is, okay, I can just do this one operation to take out this one target, and that would be the end of it, right? However, it is also very much true that you do not have the luxury of deciding. You had the luxury of deciding when and how the operation begins. You do not have the luxury of deciding where it may escalate and where it may ultimately end. And it is also true, of course, as we know, as anyone who has, you know, been alive in the last, 25 years or whatever, that much smarter men than Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth have been drawn into catastrophic wars in the Middle East that they did not intend to get involved in. That is also true. And as far as the political situation here, there has been a wide schism that's been opening up in Trump's coalition between, you know, the neocons who've been wanting to do this for 20 years, and this is like their wet dream that they're finally getting able to live out, right? Versus, you know, the isolationists who said, you know, well, Trump campaigned on no more stupid wars in the Middle East. That is true. If there's three things that Trump has been consistent on since he came down that escalator in 2015, 10 years ago, it's on that he's fucking awesome and the best at everything and is great at making deals. Also, immigration is bad and we shouldn't do it. And the third part is no more stupid wars in the Middle East. Those have been the three planks of Trumpism that have held true, right? And for him to betray one of those, I think if there's anything that could totally shatter his coalition here in the U.S. that is kind of like unexpected, you know, it's that, right? There's broad opposition to this in Congress. The president is able legally to strike Fort Doe in a sort of limited in a limited operation, right? Anything that goes days, weeks beyond that, and sort of the scope of the operation expands, right? Mission creep, that's where Congress gets involved, and legally it becomes very quick, very tricky. There's the AUMF question, the authorization for use of military force and presidential war powers. I mean, this has been debated since 9/11 extensively. It's a continuing problem that we have. I think Trump is also attuned to that. I mean, so we were talking about this before we started recording. We're recording this on around noon on the East Coast on Thursday. I thought for sure that on Tuesday, we may see strikes Tuesday night. I mean, we were planning to record this episode yesterday, and I said to you, like, yo, this is going to be totally, half of this is going to be irrelevant by Saturday. Like, I really think we should wait, right? I thought Tuesday night for sure we would probably see attacks, just reading the tea leaves and Trump's sort of rhetoric, which I think has been wildly irresponsible, just telling, you know, Tehran, a city of 10 million people, like, everyone should leave. You know, like, that's just dumb.
It is, because, I mean, even if America or Israel don't necessarily bomb it, the civilian casualties just from the mass panic, because they might think America might bomb it.
Right.
You know?
Imagine everyone in London just sort of leaving their flats and getting on a train or in a car or however you can, and just trying to leave the city, right? Clusterfuck. You can't do that. It's dangerous. Yeah. People will die.
Yeah.
That said, I think Trump has been sort of attuned to the criticism that he's sort of getting from people in his base. I mean, there's been a lot of, like, conservative influencers and everything who've flat out said, yeah, if there's boots on the ground, if we go to war in the Middle East again, like, I'm done. Like, cut me out of this. You know, I made a mistake in supporting him. I think he's sensitive to that also. I'm very scattered here. I thought on Tuesday night for sure we may see strikes. There was a moment when I thought planes would have been in the air. That didn't happen. My gut, and I could be wrong, my gut as of noon on Thursday is that he's making a push with Steve Witkoff, his Middle East envoy, to find some sort of deal that can be made here. I think it's true that at the same time he wants to bomb Fordow and sort of share in the glory of this military adventurism with Israel, because he sees Fox News praising it and it looks badass and cool to him and he doesn't want to be left out. I think that's true. I think he wants to bomb Fordow. I think he's afraid that it won't be successful. I think he's afraid that it will drag him into the conflict in ways he's not comfortable doing. I also think he wants to make a big, beautiful deal with the Iranians and also bask in that glory. I think all of those things are true. My gut right now, sitting here at noon on Thursday, I think if there's going to be a strike, an American strike on Fordow, I think it would come next week sometime. I think whatever diplomatic push there's going on in Oman right now, I think that would have to collapse.
Yeah. So let's say the US does strike Fordow. What are the likely retaliation options for the Iranians?
Their asymmetric means are not what they were, right? Whereas, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Iraqi militias are still largely intact. They have assets in Bahrain, right, where the U.S. Fifth Fleet is headquartered. All of those vessels there's British vessels there too. There's a British naval base at the same facility, right? It's a joint facility that we have between the U.S. and the U.K. in Bahrain. All of those ships have put to sea. They're underway in the Persian Gulf right now. It is true that warships are most vulnerable when they're docked pierside. Look at Pearl Harbor.
Well, look at Russia and Ukraine recently.
Yeah. Right. Even, you know, people talk about how, like, an aircraft carrier is like this big, obvious target. An aircraft carrier out in the ocean when it does not want to be found is a very small target in a very big ocean. Right.
And they have smoke machines as well where they can visually hide themselves.
Yeah. I mean, you're also talking about electronic emissions and stuff and cracking that on that. So that would be called like MCOM Alpha. Which is where, like, there's, like, no radio signals that are being sort of emitted from these warships and make them much harder to find. So the question on how the U.S., how Iran could respond, they've made it very clear that if we strike Fordow, they're going to do what they can to strike naval assets, U.S. bases in the Middle East, and also probably diplomatic facilities. Could be as far away as Eastern Europe. Whether the Iranians are able to execute on those threats, they'll try. Just given their track record so far over the course of the last 20 months, I'm skeptical of that. You know, there's been rumors over the years of Iranian cells in the U.S., right, that would also activate and do various terrorist attacks in this kind of scenario. I'm skeptical of that also. You know, I just they don't. If they've shown anything in the last 20, if the Iranians have shown anything in the last 20 months, it's that they were hyper-focused on, you know, beating Iranian women for not covering their hair properly and thinking that that was a greater threat than the Mossad agents just devouring their shit like Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm just, the Iranians are in a bad place here. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. The Iranians are in a really bad place here. Their regime change question has been talked about extensively. I think it could conceivably happen, whether the U.S. or Israel wants to affect that or not. I think regardless of how this conflict ends, there will be challenges to the regime. I think they've lost the ability to assert themselves as a national hegemon, right? I think if, you know, look at the comparison with Syria, right? Okay. If there was a figure like Ahmed al-Shara, the rebel leader who's now running Syria, if there was a figure like that in Iran, there's never been a coordinated armed opposition against the regime. There's been protest movements, color sort of revolutions, but the opposition has largely been centered in civil society. Yes, there are Iranian separatist groups like Pajak, or Balochistan separatists, right? Near Pakistan. They're responsible for a terrorist attack in Iran last year, but they don't represent they've never represented an existential threat to the regime. To that point, though, I think if there was a organized armed opposition to the regime and a figure like Ahmed al-Shara, I think he probably would be in Tehran right now, you know? And the fact that there isn't is a real issue and will prove to be far more fracturous if the regime does fall. But regardless of how this ends, the regime faces real challenges to its survival going forward. I think they've lost the ability to assert that they're unchallenged in their rule of that country.
Yeah. Is there a horrible kind of drawn out scenario where, okay, yes, we've taken out most of Iran's nuclear facilities, but Israel does not succeed in, toppling the Iranian government, nor do the Iranian people. Maybe there's even an attempt, but the regime somehow clings on to power. What do you think could happen in that sort of scenario?
I think it's probably the more likely scenario, to be honest, if I had to pick one. Right now, I don't really know what that looks like. I think it really depends on how quickly. Okay, let's say there is some sort of a settlement, whether Fordow is taken out or not, right? And the bombs stop, right? I think a lot of that, what happens after that depends on how quickly the regime is able to sort of reconstitute itself and assert its authority with its people, with a country of 90 million people. How quickly they're able to sort of regroup and show that, okay, we are intact. You know, we are able to sort of keep the trains running on time. You know, that's going to be really important. To the extent also, this is another really important point that I sort of forgot to mention. Israeli strikes they have struck infrastructure targets, such as like oil refineries and everything. If the Israelis start hammering away at the Iranian energy infrastructure, oil fields, refineries, power stations, water infrastructure, if they start chipping away at the Iranian government's ability to sort of just provide basic services for their people, that is going to be really dangerous and destabilizing. I think if the country's infrastructure remains relatively intact, but you know the nuclear program goes, I think it'd be much easier for them to survive in the short to midterm than it will be otherwise.
Yeah. And is there a scenario where a worse government could take over in Iran and it could be worse for Israel?
There's always the devil you don't know who is potentially worse. I mean, that's why on this podcast I've said, you know, the sort of the fantasizing about Putin sort of waking up dead one day or whatever. Be careful what you wish for, because the alternative is not necessarily better. You know, what that worst scenario would look like, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think it would be something along the lines of just like an outright military dictatorship, right? But then there's this sort of theocracy that sort of underpins the Iranian regime, this idea of velayat faqih, which is the jurisprudence of the supreme leader, right? The sort of ideology that means Ayatollah Khamenei, he's the guy in charge, we follow him no matter what. That would have to collapse in some way for, I think, a military dictatorship to be possible there. But I think that could potentially be worse. I mean, it's also just like they're really pissed off. They're humiliated. They want revenge. There is going to be the sort of technical know-how to build a nuclear weapon, right? There's going to be the industrial base to do so somehow. And I think that's also potentially really dangerous going forward too. But there's so many unknowns and just open questions to all of this.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier, because there's a piece you shared with me about how the opposition in Iran feel that this isn't actually helping. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, right. That was a piece in the Atlantic. Mm. I think it's true. I mean, there hasn't been, so far that we've seen, there hasn't been the great rally around the flag sort of effect that I think a lot of people sort of claim. Yeah, the minute you bomb Iran, the opposition is just all going to align themselves with the regime. That hasn't happened. I think they do know, and they're correct in their assessment that the regime put them in this place, you know? And I think that's true. In many ways, I think the regime brought this on themselves. They've talked shit against much powerful countries for 45 years. Their OPSEC has been very much not clean, I think we'll say, right? It's a terrible human tragedy what we're seeing over there in Tehran, especially. It could get worse. Yeah, no one wants to be bombed. I mean, I'm no fan of the Trump administration, of course, but if some foreign country started, you know, bombing us to get rid of Trump, I would not be happy about that. You know, like don't blow up my, I don't like Trump either, but please don't blow up my house. You know, that's just a very natural human reaction. But you know, where the opposition goes after this is going to be a really interesting question. Like I said, it's typically been rooted in Iranian civil society. Will there be some sort of organized armed opposition to the regime that follows this? I don't know, but it's a question I'd be asking. And if I was in Mossad or Saudi intelligence or the CIA somewhere, that's certainly a question that people are asking. How can we, after this, is there a path forward for us to give the regime just that little push to create an Ahmed al-Shara type of figure who could govern the country? Because like I said, I think if there was that sort of figure, if there was an organized armed opposition, I think chances are good they'd be in Tehran right now.
Yeah. And they certainly aren't at this time. Is there anything else you want to add? Because we can, in a minute, we'll move on to Russia, China. But any final thoughts?
I don't have a whole lot else right now. I think that covers it. I'm 50-50 on whether there will be strikes, a U.S. strike on Fordo. I think that really depends on how the sort of diplomatic push goes in the next few days, and also how much cold feet Trump gets from the outcry within the MAGA base. That's a big question, because he pays attention to that. He is attuned
to that.
Tucker
Carlson's turned on him. It's amazing, you know.
Yeah. Worst person you know makes a good point once in a while. Heartbreaking news, as that meme goes. Tucker is an ideologue and a pro-Russian stooge and paid for. Tucker's an asshole. The realist in me, looking at the threat that the Iranian regime has represented to Western interests for 45 years, and looking at the potential of possibly World War III with China and Russia within our lifetimes, I think it is objectively true to take these people off the field, right? I'm also very realistic to the dangers of doing so and the inexperience of the people with the reins to do so right now. And again, I go back to, you have the luxury of deciding when and how an operation begins. You do not have the luxury of deciding when and how it ends. And again, I say, much smarter men than Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth have been drawn into disastrous conflicts in the Middle East that they did not intend to get into. So I'm torn between all of these feelings right now.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree with you on that. Yeah, and look, certainly the mood in Britain at this time, I mean, the British government sort of just pushing the diplomacy card, saying people should come together. And certainly the sort of feeling on the street does tend to be kind of, at least in London, it's more anti-Israeli. And unfortunately, then it kind of, you end up in this position where you get people who are becoming pro-Iran and becoming a bit kind of blinded to the realities of Iran.
I think if you're just sort of going off social media vibes and stuff, and you don't really know a whole lot about who the Iranians are, what the history of this is, all the consequences and stuff, complications and everything. I mean, yeah, I think it's sort of natural to arrive at that position, especially if you're sort of more oriented on the left and have been rightfully opposed to Israel's conduct in Gaza since October 7th.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And yeah, as I said earlier, I don't think Israel winning any hearts and minds of all this. Coming back to what Eamon Deem is saying, I mean, he thinks this is a historic moment where one could get rid of the Iranian regime, which has been terrible for its people. And yeah, so we'll see. We will see what happens, really, because I don't know. I mean, when we look back on this in maybe 10 years' time, we will be able to better say whether it was a positive or a negative.
Yeah, that's entirely true. Whether the outcome of this, whether it'll be good or bad, there's real reasons to be seriously concerned that it'll be bad. We just don't know.
No, indeed. Well, unless you want to say anything else, I think this is probably a good point to pause and just finish up, really. Yeah.
We'll have more coverage on this going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well, let's take a break and be back with more.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Welcome back, everybody. So we're going to now just shift over to Russia and China for a little bit, because even though we're very focused on Iran and Israel currently, you know, one thing I've learned through running this podcast, there's no such thing as a singular issue or a singular threat. And if anything, that's one of the things that's been a big educational point for me, is just fascinated by how I guess the general population seemed to think that when it's all about terrorism, it means somehow that conventional conflict with Russia and China doesn't matter anymore, or the war in Ukraine means we don't have to worry about the Middle East anymore. And it's like, unfortunately, we have to worry about everything because there's a lot of things to worry about. And I suppose one of my goals of the podcast is always just to help us keep an eye on other things going on as well as the kind of hot points right now. Mm-hmm. And this article from the New York Times about documents that were sourced from the internet that point to tensions within the Russia-China relationship. So I'll quickly summarize. So while President Putin presents the China-Russia relationship as an unshakable strategic alliance, a secretive FSB unit views China as a serious threat. Internal intelligence documents reveal that Russian counterintelligence considers Beijing an active adversary, accusing China of espionage, territorial ambitions, and the recruitment of Russian scientists. The FSB alleges that the Chinese agents are spying on Russia's military, especially operations in Ukraine, so they can study Western weapons and tactics. China is particularly interested in drones, aviation technology, and even defunct Soviet-era projects like the Ekranoplan, which I must admit is one of my favourite Soviet inventions, the Ekranoplan. I think even the US are looking at Ekranoplans now, potentially for their Pacific ambitions, but we'll see.
Yes.
See what happens with that. It might not be a dead concept after all.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why the Chinese are looking at the Ekranoplan right now. And if anybody doesn't know what the Ekranoplan is I'll be honest, I can't explain the science behind it, but it's a sort of big kind of aircraft or troop carrier that sort of uses, I think it's ground effects. It kind mm-hmm. of, it skims along the surface. It's kind of below radar. And some of the, if you ever watch, there's some documentaries on YouTube about them that were originally from the BBC, the Ekranoplan, they can be quite big. And I think they could carry, I don't know, I think the largest Soviet one could carry about 70 troops. It may be more or less than that, but it was about 70. Yeah,
yeah, they're meant to land troops in an invasion. Can't imagine why the Chinese would be interested in that.
Well, yeah, indeed. So,
can't maybe imagine why they went that for.
Yeah, the era of the Ekranoplan coming. But So apparently Beijing is targeting disaffected Russian scientists, and I have a feeling there's probably quite a few of them out there. And they're also targeting former military employees for recruitment. A classified FSB directive verified by Western intelligence and leaked via cyber criminals outlines a detailed strategy and it's codenamed Detente Four to resist Chinese espionage. While the FSB is actively collecting data, especially via apps like WeChat, it must tread carefully to avoid damaging diplomatic ties. So officers of the FSB have been ordered not to publicly name China as an adversary. So this release is probably quite embarrassing. Russia is increasingly worried about Chinese intentions in key regions, being the Far East, with Chinese scholars are reviving historical territorial claims. Then you got Central Asia, where Beijing is expanding soft power in former Soviet republics. And then we have the Arctic, which Chinese intelligence allegedly is using mining companies and universities to spy on Arctic development, especially as Russia becomes more reliant on Chinese support amid Western sanctions. The documents show that despite the deep suspicions, Russia continues to prioritize its relationship with China out of a strategic necessity, economically, diplomatically, and militarily. Some analysts believe that the West could exploit the internal distrust, but others argue Putin is too committed to the partnership to be swayed. So Matt, was there anything that sort of stood out for you in this article?
You know, this this conceit that Russia and China are and would continue to be equal partners in this, you know, axis of opposition to the Western, shall we say, US-led world order has always been a Russian fantasy, I think. I mean, Putin needs to believe that. The Russians need to believe that. But the contours of their relationship, especially since the war in Ukraine began and Russia became majorly dependent on Chinese military equipment and help evading Western sanctions, has always been tilted toward Beijing. I mean, don't get me wrong. They're friends. They're allied against us. But Beijing's ideal world order certainly places Moscow as a junior partner in a Chinese-dominated Eastern Hemisphere. Russia needs China more than China needs Russia. But, I mean, China also likely has great concerns. This wasn't spelled out in the article, but I think China also likely has great concerns about what happens in Russia once Putin's rule ends.
Either naturally, like we all do, actually.
Right. count us among them, either naturally or through more kinetic means, if you catch my meaning. The fallout from that, you know, depending on how sideways it goes, could absolutely create serious problems for China. The same problems they would create for us. Of course, I mean, we don't share a, you know, 2,400, I think, mile border with Russia. I mean, allies also do sometimes have good motivation to spy on each other for reasons other than seeking to harm or subjugate. We've talked about this in terms of the U.S. trying to keep tabs on German political deliberations, or how Israel has spied on the U.S. extensively for decades. I mean, I think European countries right now have very good reasons to try to figure out what's happening behind the curtains in Washington, right? I would not be outraged by that news. I would be like, yeah, that makes sense. If I was, you know, Macron or Starmer right now, and my intelligence agencies had the means to sort of give me what's going on in the White House behind the scenes, yeah, I would want to know if I was them. I couldn't fault them for that. This campaign, however, seems to be done with the seems to be done in the context of keeping Russia down and perpetually the junior partner. And in that regard, you know, I think there's no honor among thieves, I guess. But that's sort of what I think about that. I don't know if you had any thoughts.
Yeah. No, I echo that. I mean, yeah, we talked about it. We talked about it a few months ago, didn't we? About that kind of power imbalance at the root of this relationship, because Russia sees itself as a world power and possibly even a European power. And if anybody ever so slightly kind of slights them or treats them as less than that, could see the end of the Russian relationship with China. But obviously Russia is in a difficult place because of Western sanctions right now, and they need China because China basically at the moment has sort of saved Russia from total bankruptcy. So so I think when maybe things change, that's where we'll start to see where their relationship, you know, how it really goes, and they're in a kind of more confident position, but we will see. I was also interested about the origins of the document. So there was a kind of an additional article linked to the New York Times article that we'll talk about, where they talk about how they got these documents. And apparently in November, a crime group called Ares Leaks announced on Telegram that it was selling classified Russian intelligence documents. Now, they're not cheap. If anybody's out there thinking about buying them, they're like 10 grand plus a pop. If I had a lot of money, if I had won the lottery, I probably would have bought some, but I haven't. So there we go. but the group claimed that the records originated from inside the Federal Security Service, which is the FSB. Now, the New York Times refuses to pay for stolen documents, but they're happy to accept documents that are provided without costs or strings attached. So instead of buying the documents, they received a sample of these FSB documents in question, and they got that from Ares Leaks. Now, the New York Times then took those documents to six Western intelligence agencies, and all of them confirmed that the documents appeared authentic. Based on the kind of format and content. They also independently verified that the Russian government had in fact been conducting precautionary briefings with Russians who traveled to China for work. So they feel that these documents are legit. And now how Ares Leaks acquired these documents is unclear. The group apparently did not answer any requests from the New York Times to comment on how they got them. But Russian agencies have been hacked before, and it could also even be an FSB officer mishandled these documents, or that they were stolen, or an insider may have sold or leaked them for money, and Ares grabbed them, you know, from that person, or they may have grabbed them from another criminal group. However it obtained them, the crime group now is advertising multiple tranches of Russian documents, and also documents about North Korea and more about China, India, and other countries. And apparently has offered the entire cache of Russian intelligence documents, if anybody out there has money, for $120,000, which I feel is kind of a bargain. On an interesting note as well, I find it fascinating how leaky Russia has gotten the last few years. You know, we've had the successes of Bellingcat, who's exposed the identity of FSB and GRU members who've been involved in hostile activity in the West. And even the CIA and MI6 appear to have benefited from Russian leaks, as they have, you know, managed to get a lot more insight about Russian intentions with Ukraine and the build-up to Russia's invasion that we even probably know about. So despite all the risks, there does appear, it is possible that there are people within the ranks of the Russian intelligence services right now leaking documents, mainly for money. And I find that very interesting. So, yeah, so definitely one to keep an eye on, I think.
You got to be pretty motivated to, you know, half expect a bullet in the back of your head in the basement of Lubyanka or Lefortovo prison or something. But
yeah, or poisoning abroad. I guess maybe whoever this person is, if they're not leaking it to an intelligence service, but to a criminal group, like that, maybe they think there's a higher chance they could get away with it. You know, maybe they've rationaled it's not quite the treachery it is. You know, maybe. I don't know. It's an interesting one.
I would offer, though, that I can't imagine intelligence agencies aren't routinely monitoring the dark web for these stolen documents that pop up.
Oh,
and,
they are.
And buy them when they're available.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure. I mean, God, that $120,000 is a bargain probably for America and MI6 if you put their budgets into perspective.
I'm sure I would love to see the cables at Langley between like accountants and operations people being like, hey, we should pay this. And it's like, I don't know. I think 120 grand is a little bit steep. I don't know that's in the budget. I mean, that's a totally a bureaucratic, nonsensical thing. It happens in intelligence agencies all the time.
Well, we'll find out, I'm sure, in the future whether they did buy them or not. So just a couple of other things of note before we wrap up. So MI6 is going to get a new C. Her name is
Judi Dench.
Well, yes. I know, it's interesting, actually. So this the new head of MI6 is going to be a woman, which is the first time in MI6's 116-year history that a woman is actually going to be in charge of MI6. But popular culture has been ahead of MI6, and really Judi Dench has been ahead of MI6 since 1995.
In our hearts, yes.
So Blaise Mertawelli is the new, is going to be the new C, and she's, as I said, the first woman to lead MI6 officially. And she will succeed Sir Richard Moore later this year. In fact, in October, she will succeed him, and she will become the 18th chief or C of the Secret Intelligence Services. Mertawelli joined MI6 in 1999 and currently oversees technology and innovation as Director General. So she's kind of the Q of MI6 currently.
Yeah.
And she's also held senior roles apparently in MI5 and worked extensively across the Middle East and Europe. And she's known for her expertise in countering high-tech surveillance and advancing covert capabilities. So, she seems like the right woman for the right time. Because I think do you remember the talk between Sir Richard Moore and Bill Burns? I think it was last year. Richard Moore made a comment about how, not that MI6 isn't taking technology seriously, but it has to go even further with technology. Technology is very much going to be the name of the game going forward. So I think it's been a wise move to appoint Mertawelli, because there were other candidates in the running. So there's a lady called Dame Barbara Woodward, who was the she's currently the UK's permanent representative to the United Nations, and she was a former ambassador to China. And she was reportedly in the running, and she's obviously a seasoned diplomat with deep expertise in Chinese affairs. But her candidacy was seen as a sort of bold external choice. But she did face criticism, mostly being nicknamed as Beijing Barbara by her detractors, who questioned her perceived cautions towards Chinese government during her ambassadorship, particularly around sensitive issues like human rights. And obviously, she had no intelligence expertise either. And I think that, you know, appointing her over Mertawelli could have been a bad move, especially with the whole sort of technology focus and things. I don't know, it's difficult to say, but I feel like my feeling is Mertawelli feels like the right choice on paper. She certainly has all the expertise and everything, and she's only 47, so I'm like, crikey, I've got a bit of envy there now.
Yeah,
she's doing well for somebody who's only 47 years old, so they're only a few years older than me. So yeah, Matt, any thoughts on the new head of MI6?
Yeah, I agree. I'm always happy to see a career intelligence official take the reins of one of these agencies. I mean, I wish that's something we did for the CIA director, rather than them usually being more of a political appointee. I mean, there have been circumstances. Gina Haspel was a career official, and I think by and large did a pretty good job during the first Trump administration. But, you know, you mentioned the technology thing, her background running QBranch, essentially. Good point there. I mean, so much of, you know, how CIA, MI6, how they deal with issues like biometrics, countering biometrics, or like, you know, just ubiquitous surveillance, social media, that makes it, you know, really difficult for human intelligence personnel to operate overseas, especially when you're dealing with like a non-official cover. You know, those technologies have made it really difficult on the human side. Totally agree there. I also think it's also good to see she has experience at MI5. You know, so many of the threats the UK faces now and going into the future revolve around countering Russian and Chinese intelligence, disinformation and radicalization online, and strategic sabotage from the Russians. So I think having an MI6 chief who knows these threats well and has faced them, rather than spending their career in an embassy far away from London, not there's anything wrong with that, I think could be useful in sort of calibrating that cooperation between MI6 and MI5, because so many of the UK's main security threats right now are internal threats, you know. So how they work together there, and having that sort of institutional knowledge and relationship there could be really important.
Yeah, indeed. I just only hope that she has her own Q boat, like from the World Is Not Enough.
Her little fishing boat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't, I hope she gets one by the time she finishes. But there we go. I wish her luck. So there we are. Now we're going to just wrap up just lastly on the death of Frederick Forsyth, who is the legendary novelist behind The Day of the Jackal. I was very sad to hear of his passing. You know, just a quick overview of his obituary. He was born in 1938. He served as one of the RAF's youngest pilots, later working as a journalist and war correspondent, and reportedly secretly worked for MI6 for 20 years. And all of that, you know, when you now know that, has obviously deeply informed his fiction. And I think that's why I've always enjoyed his fiction over some other authors, because there always was this sense of authenticity. And I think they even named it Faction, which is sort of fact and fiction merged together. And I've always kind of liked that. You know, for me, and I've said this before, I love a spy book to give me a sense of a peek behind the curtain. And Forsyth's work really did that. I think Day of the Jackal was definitely one of my favourites. I also really enjoyed a book called The Shepherd, which is all about this sort of ghost pilot who guides a lost pilot back safely to base. And it was a really cool one. And they even adapted that into a short film on Disney Plus. And I think it was John Travolta was in that. But that's a whole other thing. The book's really great and very moving. So yeah, Forsyth died at the age of 86. I think he, you know, did very well. And apparently there's a documentary coming out on his life called In My Own Words. It's due to be released by the BBC. And he has a final novel, The Revenge of Odessa, which has been co-written with Tony Kent, which will be published in August. So, yeah, you know, RIP to Frederick Forsyth. I'll be honest, didn't always agree with his politics, but I very much enjoyed his work.
Brexit guy.
Yeah. He was a big Brexiteer. So, you know, always very interesting, Matt. Any thoughts on Forsyth yourself, Matt?
Forsyth was a big inspiration for me in my own writing. I mean, sort of Le Carre, Clancy, and Forsyth are sort of within the genre, the big three for me.
Yeah, it's good Mount Rushmore, that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
You know, one of the all-time greats, one of the best to ever do it. Rest in peace, sir. I should definitely reread Day of the Jackal at some point this summer. I haven't picked that up in years.
Yeah, I've still not read the Odessa file, and a few people who were commenting on it say that's his best book, so I need to read that. I really enjoyed one called The Deceiver. It's kind of a collection of stories, and not too dissimilar from Spy Game, about an MI6 officer who's being kind of questioned about his past. That's a really good book as well, The Deceiver.
Yeah, awesome.
Well, I think that is us for today. So thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please obviously connect with us on all the socials except for X, because we're not really on that. That's been mothballed. But we are on Blue Sky predominantly, and Instagram. So that's where you'll usually find me. And you know, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon subscriber, and you can get access to the ad-free versions of this episode. Don't forget, you can also watch us on YouTube, so you can look at me and Matt chatting to each other if that's what you're into. And hello there if you are on YouTube. So yeah, thank you again, everybody, for watching and listening. Matt, are you up to anything exciting this weekend?
Probably glued to the TV.
Yeah,
and my social media feads as I have been for the past few days. Yeah, I really hope the first hour of this episode isn't totally irrelevant by the time it airs. I think it will be. I tried to calibrate it with that in mind. I think next week is the week to watch, though. That's my gut. Maybe this will prove poorly by the time it airs, but who knows?
Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye on things as things go on. Well, thank you again, everybody, and we will catch you on the next episode. Take care. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the East and North sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the East and North sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the East and North sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.